Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing, downloading and so on. If you like the show, let people know and rate it. It does help the stats. On this episode, we're going to be talking about space elevators. I mean, it's not a new idea, but it is a very cool one. The idea that we could somehow use the centripetal force of the Earth to create a cable from the equator all the way to outer space to basically build an elevator. Very cool idea. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're @NewstalkScience. But first, we're going to take a look back at the week's science news. Of course, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland joins me, as does Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Ruth, our first story has to do with Plato.
It does. Not usually the starting point on this show, but this is really the latest, really exciting results from, I suppose, something you call the Vesuvius Challenge, although it's been going on for a long time. And it's about scrolls of papyrus that were discovered in a town called Herculaneum, which is sort of the less famous town beside Pompeii, which was also hugely damaged and destroyed when Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD. And in Herculaneum, there was a villa which was a library, and it was filled with papyrus scrolls. And when Mount Vesuvius erupted, these scrolls, as the sort of mud and pyroclastic dust came down, they were instantly carbonized and then covered in mud. And they were actually preserved as sort of, they looked like lumps of charcoal for hundreds and hundreds of years until a farmer discovered them in the 18th century. And since then, scholars have been looking at them going, how do we get at this information? Because it's probably one of the most perfectly preserved, even though it's not at all preserved in a way, libraries from antiquity. And over the course of the last 100 years, people have come up with very elaborate ways to try and unpick these scrolls, open them like at a speed of a millimetre a week, and the ink on them would just almost disappear. You could barely see it, and people would try and catch little bits of words. But in 2023, a new challenge was set up. And the idea was these scrolls were put in CT scanners and high definition x-rays were taken, and all this material was put online. And essentially the computer science community was challenged to see, could they use machine learning, AI techniques to virtually unwrap these scrolls and try and differentiate in this burnt papyrus what was ink and what was not ink.
So the scrolls are rolled up. And they're basically encased. You can't look in them.
They look like a fire log.
And so essentially they're using a CT scan to identify where the ink molecules essentially are laying in this 3D structure, and then unraveling that using machine learning.
Exactly.
Wow.
So it's an amazing thing. But actually the first word, which was that won the first prize, it actually turned out to be an undergraduate student from the University of Nebraska. And last year he, through his machine learning algorithm, saw a word materialize.
That's so cool.
And the first word was purple. And after that, there's other prizes for passages of text that have been uncovered. So again, a few months ago, the first passage and the first sentence appeared in these scrolls that no one has looked at for hundreds
purple.
Of years. Purple was the first word.
I thought that was a modern colour. I thought that was one of those things that we...
The Romans had purple.
We're only talking about a couple of thousand years ago. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively recent.
Wasn't it Homer? When he wrote about things, it was one of the colours that was missing in his language, as in they just didn't have the colour. It mustn't have been purple, so.
Yeah, no, I think they had, but again, you know, they've come up with now sentences, but this is really interesting because it's about Plato, and obviously, you know, one of the founders of Western philosophy, and it is the story of how Plato spent his last night, described probably by a man who was kind of a scholar in this library. So it turns out he spent his last night in bed. He wasn't well. But he was listening to music being played on a flute by a Thracian girl, a slave girl. Apparently he didn't like it very much and he offered a bit of a criticism of it. So he's still well enough to do that.
Later to the end.
Yeah, but then it also described where he was buried. So until now, we kind of knew that he was probably buried in the garden of the Athens Academy, but we never knew where. But this describes exactly where he was put when
My
he died.
God.
And so beside a sacred shrine to the muses. And it also tells us things that we never knew, like when he was sold into slavery, when he was younger. So it's really kind of incredible to suddenly get access to this material.
Absolutely. And you know, about Plato himself, I mean, they couldn't have got a more exciting thing to discover. Have you ever played Assassin's Creed, Shane?
No.
No. I knew that would be the answer.
Me neither, Shane.
Can I say, as someone who enjoys history and learning, this game, Assassin's Creed Odyssey, was written as a story based in the Greek times, right? But what the researchers did is they spent years studying all of the ancient buildings, and they've recreated them exactly as they were.
Oh, I like
in
that.
in their as they were at the time, based on ruins and colors and huge amount of research. And when you play it, you feel like you're on holiday. It's actually an extraordinary game just to walk around. And there's a lot of slaughtering in it required, but it is an amazing, amazing game. Fantastic story. Yeah. Shane.
And 600 more scrolls to read. So we've got lots more exciting.
Oh, it's a very exciting.
Very TBD.
TPC, yeah.
Shane, our second story has to do with astronauts keeping fit.
Yeah, so from the long distant past to the near future. This is a lunar wall of death, right? Which does not sound good. Yet another reason why I would not want to be an astronaut. So one of the main challenges of being an astronaut, and there are many, is that you lose muscle mass. So basically there's no gravity or very little gravity relative to that on the Earth. And so you just waste away. And
yeah. That's not you can't do a push-up because... Well, there's no push-up.
Well, there's no gravity that you have to fight against or just walking around and lifting things. Your muscles just go. So you need to create forces that you can work against. Now, if you want a force, basically what you can do is you can either change your velocity or you can change your direction. Every Leaving Cert physics student would know that one. So we experience that in a car. If you slam on the brakes, you accelerate, you'll feel the force difference. Or if you go around a roundabout, you'll feel that kind of force that pulled you outward. That's what a wall of death does. So for anyone that doesn't know what they are, basically they're a big cylinder, right? You normally put some person on a motorbike inside and they have to reach quite a high speed, and they're able to basically go up the side of the wall of death and do these kind of incredible feats. And so what the people in this paper from Milan are suggesting is that astronauts could use a wall of death on the moon and they could run in it. Right. And they could run
like a hamster wheel on its side.
Exactly, Jonathan. That is a fantastic way of describing it, much better than I could do. So because the gravity on the moon is a sixth that of Earth, they don't have to run that fast in order to get up to the minimum speed to be able to do this hamster wheel on the side scenario. You only have to run 13 kilometers an hour, which I reckon even I could do. Incidentally, if you wanted to do this on Earth, I worked it out. The minimum velocity is the square root of gravity times the radius of the wall of death. So for 10 meters, right, that would be effectively you'd have to go at 36 kilometers an hour, which is almost as fast as Usain Bolt, right? So pretty damn fast.
So Usain Bolt could do the wall of death just with his feet.
Yeah, you probably could. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a show I want to watch. That's a show I want to watch. So obviously, creating a wall is very easy because it doesn't move. It's just a cylinder. So keeping astronauts fit, obviously, space is difficult to get stuff up, but it's not difficult to construct. You can make it from.
Yeah, well, what they're saying is rather than bring extra stuff, why not just build the habitats that they live in a cylindrical shape, and basically they'll run on the walls of where they're living.
That would literally driving me up the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good. Okay, Ruth, our third story is quite exciting. Personalised cancer vaccines are closer.
Yeah, that's right. And this has really been driven by the fact that many of us got mRNA vaccines during COVID. And this is kind of where this technology is now going. It comes, from Moderna, who is the company that was a sort of spearheaded a lot of that technology. And this is a vaccine that has gone into phase 3 trials for melanoma, for the most serious type of skin cancer. And the way this works is it targets something called neoantigens. So obviously cancer cells come from our own cells. And that's one of the challenges when you're trying to treat cancer, because if you don't have a very specific treatment, you're killing the healthy cells in your body as well. Mm. But neoantigens are only expressed on tumour cells. And this is a very personalised sort of way of dealing with a tumour. So when someone has a melanoma, obviously it's removed and then it's analysed. And what this does is it, with that analysis, can predict the people who are likely to get a recurrence of that melanoma. And that's really who this vaccine is targeting. So with those people, you can again look at the genetic material, and it does also use machine learning, which we're hearing more and more, to try and predict which are the antigens or the little markers that are likely to come back if this cancer comes back, and then design for an individual patient a vaccine which will code for all of those different antigens. And it can be up to 34 different neoantigens that will be in one vaccine. So it'll be designed for that specific patient, and then they're given.
But they had to have had melanoma before.
Yes.
But that's a cancer that does recur.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. This is to prevent recurrence. So they did a phase two trial with 150 patients, which had a very, very strong, successful signal. So now they've moved into a much bigger trial. They have about 10 sites in the UK and it's in Australia as well.
Wow.
So they're going to be recruiting hundreds of patients now, all of whom are at high risk of recurrence of this very dangerous melanoma. They're very, very optimistic. There's huge excitement because of the personalised nature of this. I think one of the researchers described it, it's like being able to take your patient to the fat duck instead of taking them to McDonald's.
Wow.
That's the difference in the kind of quality of treatment that they're giving to these people. So it's very, very exciting. And of course, the huge potential here is that this could be used for other kinds of cancer. So they think it could have huge potential for kidney, lung and bladder cancer particularly. So it is potentially, I know the word game changer gets used a lot, but here this is a whole new way to treat cancer.
Amazing. Shane, we started with Plato and we're finishing with Pluto.
Yes, not the dog, the dwarf planet and the little heart that's on its side. So in 2015, NASA's New Horizon mission showed us that there was a heart shape on the surface of Pluto. And we didn't know why. It's kind of odd. All we know about Pluto is it's not a planet anymore, to everyone's bemusement. And so there's been a great puzzle that scientists have been working on, and they used simulations, like your game that you were talking about a minute ago, except it's kind of real life stuff, you know, and that scientists do all the time, these simulations. It's much like that game you were talking about. So they look at lots of different scenarios and they run them through their computer model until they get something that pops out that looks like reality. And then they're able to imagine what might have caused that. So what they reckon happened was that a very large object slowly and obliquely hit the surface of Pluto. And that collision caused this heart shape on the surface of Pluto. They're able to tell from their calculations that the heart is made of solid nitrogen, which is pretty incredible.
Wow.
Because like liquid nitrogen is cold, minus 296 degrees Celsius. So solid nitrogen is even colder, right? Because solids normally always occur at colder temperatures than liquids. So this is a pretty extreme environment.
So a giant ice cube of liquid nitrogen hit...
No. What hit Pluto wasn't made of nitrogen.
Oh, right.
The surface
is made of
solid nitrogen. And they know that because basically what happens is that surface is convecting. So it's kind of slowly kind of moving and smoothing as it does that. And that results in it being very, very reflective. So when we see Pluto with a telescope, we see a very shiny part of it.
Wow.
It's heart-shaped. And it's heart-shaped because of that solid nitrogen that's smooth.
And so what I mean, obviously, you know, if you see something on the planet and it's got a big line, that's easy to figure out. The fact that it was a heart shape was sort of a puzzle that research was trying to figure out. How can something make this shape? And so they basically threw in a virtual world, they threw various stuff at the surface to see how do we make this shape over and over again.
Exactly. They kept changing the size of the object that was hitting Pluto and
the direction, the speed and
direction and speed and the composition of Pluto itself until they got something that looked like reality.
So very likely to be that, but
yeah.
It is...
More to be done.
It is a simulation.
Of course, okay. More arguments about why Pluto is not a planet to follow as well.
Yeah, very good. Well, Dr. Shane Bergen.
Do you know why?
Huh?
Do you know why Pluto is not a planet?
Size, isn't it?
The orbit, is it?
So it does meet the condition for orbit because it goes around the sun. It does meet the size criteria. So size criteria means it's massive enough such that it's spherical, right?
Okay.
But it doesn't meet the last criteria for a planet, which is that it mops up other objects around it because
no
of
moons.
Its gravity. So it does have a moon, but it doesn't mop them up in the same way that large planets like Earth would. So effectively, it's like objects that are in the asteroid
Worst
belt.
Criterion ever.
Absolutely, because it's
big. Doesn't mop
makes
up
it, makes it on the two main ones.
It Come does. On. Yeah, I call it a planet, but like I'm going to get emails about that now.
There's someone at the door, actually. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. Thanks very much. All right. On the way, how to build a space elevator. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us science@newstalk.com, tweet us @newstalkscience, or you can WhatsApp us 087 1400 106. Now, anyone who's interested in space exploration will know that if you want to get to somewhere like Saturn, you've got to swing around a bunch of different planets over and over again to get up enough speed to get there. And the reason for that is we use the gravity of the planets to build up speed. But couldn't we use the spin of a planet to create centripetal force here on Earth for something I think even way cooler than a trip to Saturn, and that is a space elevator. And it might be just crazy enough to work. Our own Mizra is Thomas Workman, Emeritus Professor of Mechanical Engineering at McGill. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Aaron. I am fascinated with this idea. It's such a crazy, Roald Dahl, nonsense idea, but the physics is theoretically there. Can you talk to me about a space elevator? What exactly is one?
Yes. Well, it sounds crazy, but it's not really that crazy. It has scientific basis, and in fact, a lot of advances have been made to make space elevator a reality. Well, it's not going to happen next year, but a space elevator has been talked about for more than 100 years, you know, started from Tsiolkovsky, the Russian scientist, but also Sir Arthur Clarke also talked about it. But a lot of technical developments have taken place. So basically what it is that right now the way people envision space elevator is that starting from the surface of the Earth in the equatorial plane, we'll build a very tall structure, but very thin structure that will be almost 100,000 kilometers long beyond the geostationary altitude. You need to go beyond the geostationary altitude to have all the dynamic equilibrium working out.
100,000 kilometer long cable.
100,000 kilometer long, around that.
Wow.
Well, the length will depend on what is the mass of the anchor body at the top of the elevator. So it can be more or less than 100,000 kilometers, but it is of the order of 100,000 kilometers.
Okay.
We have to have that because the geostationary radius from the center of the Earth is slightly over 42,000 kilometers. That means 36,000 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. So if you want to go to geostationary orbits, you have to have a structure longer than that. So what will happen is that you'll have a climber that will climb along this long, tall structure. And then depending on where you release the payload from the climber, it will get to different orbits. It can go to orbits which are at low Earth altitudes, or it could be geostationary satellites, or you can even, in principle, launch a payload to go to Mars, if you launch it sufficiently high up.
So I want to visualize this for people. If you imagine the Earth spinning around as it does, and out of it a long, extraordinarily thin cable that goes from the equator of our planet 100,000 kilometers up into space, and it's counterbalanced by a giant weight. Tell me how the physics of that works. How can something float in space and keep a cable taut in that way?
It is actually not floating in space. The full space elevator is anchored to the ground. So it's not floating in space. It is rotating at the same angular velocity as the Earth because it's in the equatorial plane. It's attached to the Earth. When the Earth rotates, this structure is also rotating. It's not floating.
Yeah.
Although, when you mention about floating, there have been now concepts for partial space elevators, which will be really floating. So the center of mass of this partial space elevator will be at the geostationary altitude, that is 36,000 kilometers altitude from the Earth. And then around this center of mass, there'll be maybe a 40,000 kilometer long partial space elevator, which will provide partial benefits, not the full benefits of the full space elevator.
Right.
Now, why people are thinking about partial space elevator to start with before building the full space elevator is the following. The full space elevator will require material which will have to be very strong. They have to have tensile strength of the order of 100 units, 100 megapascal, while steel has a strength of only 4 megapascal. Now, we do have materials like that, like single crystal graphene, carbon nanotubes, boron nitrides. There are materials like that, but we cannot produce them in sufficient amount so that, you know, you can have a long, tall structure, 100,000 kilometers long. So to start with, before our material science develops and we can manufacture these material in large quantities as one long structure, we can probably have a partial space elevator. But when we have eventually the full space elevator, it's not going to be just one elevator. what people are thinking is that you will have actually three harbors in three different areas, a Pacific harbor, maybe an Atlantic harbor, and Indian Ocean harbor. And there'll be three space elevators working together. And each space elevator is not just going to have one cable. It will probably have several cables, you know, to give it redundancy so that, you know,
if one cable breaks, you're in big trouble.
Right. So you will have several strands. And, you know,
how big are these cables that you're talking about? Because like 100,000 kilometers is extraordinary. But then you look at some of the giant engineering and projects on this planet that we've achieved already. And there's some incredible physics that we've already managed. If we manage to use carbon nanotubes and produce them in such a quantity that we could use them for a project like this, how wide would they be? Would they be a meter wide? Would they be like giant columns? Or how wide would they need to be able to hold these sort of structures as they travel up and down a space elevator?
Okay. There have been several proposals. In some proposals, the tether is going to be only a few centimeters in diameter.
What?
Few centimeters in diameter, that's all. But the newest proposals are not to use a tether, but to use a ribbon made out of graphene or carbon nanotube. And these ribbons will be very thin, just like sellotapes, very thin, but the width of the ribbon could be of the order of maybe 50 centimeters or so. It's a very, very, you know, you can see that the aspect ratio, very tall structure, 100,000 kilometer long, but the size is about, you know, a few centimeters, less than 100 centimeters.
So this is crazy. This cannot work in my mind, but I want you to talk me through it. So this cable, this ribbon, that's, you know, a few centimeters wide, super thin, going all the way up to the space elevator. I mean, how do you protect something like that? And how? I mean, could it really be strong enough to carry things up into space being, you know, no matter how strong it is, being that thin?
Yes. Okay. When we say it is going to space elevator, no. The whole structure is called the space elevator. So a climber will climb up the ribbon and from various altitudes, a payload can be released. Now, a lot of calculations have been made by many people. And they have seen that the ribbon will be able to survive the forces that are involved in moving these climbers up and down. The ribbon is not going to break. The ribbon will be under tremendous stress, and it will have a stress which will be of the order of many kilopascal or even megapascal, very, very large stress. But the material is strong, and that's why we're looking for carbon nanotube or graphene or boron nitride. And these materials will be able to survive the stresses that are involved in moving a payload across.
Okay. Well, how big are these proposed climbers, by the way? Are they the size of normal elevators? Are they much smaller?
They're much smaller. They could be 100 kilograms, maybe a few hundred kilograms in size.
Okay. That's not small. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about how... let's just fast forward, and we've developed a way of mass producing carbon nanotubes to create this incredibly long cable that goes all the way to space. Like, it's just crazy. Imagine we could do that, right? Because that's one step. But then how do you get the counterweight up in space to start with? And how do you attach something like that? I mean, I'm imagining something like do you connect the counterweight to the top of the cable that's been connected via shuttle or something? Or how do you do it?
Okay, let me just describe very briefly what is the proposal, how to build this space elevator. It's not going to be built from ground up. So what will happen is that maybe a spacecraft will take some ribbon material and probably other infrastructure to geostationary altitude, and then we'll start deploying from this geostationary altitude this ribbon in both directions. So you could have a counterweight also at the end of the ribbon. So you are going to deploy it starting from the geostationary altitude, from 42,000 kilometer radial distance from the center of the Earth. So it will be going, part of it will go up, part of it will go down because of the dynamics involved. If you deploy something down, then actually some other part will move up. And then when the ribbon then reaches the ground, then it will be anchored.
Yeah.
But as I said, people are thinking about partial space elevators. So what they will do initially, I believe, is that they will deploy a structure like this, but probably it will not be 100,000 kilometers long, but probably 40,000 kilometers long. So you'll have 20,000 up above the geostationary altitude, 20,000 below. So it will not reach the ground, but it will be a very long structure, and it will provide partial benefits so that a payload can go to the bottom end of this 40,000 kilometer payload, then climb up.
I'm kind of imagining kind of like a balloon with a string hanging down, although you don't need a balloon because it's space is providing the lack of gravity.
Right. So you are going to actually build it from up. So you are going to deploy it from the geostationary. You are not going to start constructing from ground. That's not going to work.
Yeah. Okay. No, but I'm just wondering the counterweight, how you get there. But I presume if we find a way to launch a counterweight into space, it's probably easy. It might be easy enough, or at least easy enough for today's engineers and aerospace technicians to connect the top of the cable to some sort of counterweight. If we're talking about the full space elevator, it should be easy enough to connect the ribbon to something in space because we can move quite carefully in space.
Yes. Okay. But it is not going to be built in one phase. So what we are going to do is that you will have a space elevator. It may be 100,000 kilometers, but it will have only, let's say, two strands. And then it will have a small counterweight, and gradually you are going to use other missions to gradually make it
a larger
space elevator.
I want to move on from the technical thing and talk a little bit about what it might bring us, because it sounds incredibly cool. How on earth, once you get that, how on earth do you decide what to do with it? I mean, what would a space elevator be useful for?
Yes. Now, at present, we launch satellites, or we launch a spacecraft to other planets using chemical rockets. And it costs us probably of the order of $20,000, maybe even $50,000, depending on who is launching it, per kilogram to take this payload from the surface of the Earth to a particular altitude. And where you are taking it, depending on that, the cost will be different. And the cost also will be different depending on who is the launcher. You know, India and China can launch much more cheaply. But even then, it will be of the order of tens of thousands of dollars per kilogram. Mm. Now, what the space elevator can do is that it can take payloads for much less cost, like $500 per kilogram.
Wow.
Compared to tens or $20,000 per kilogram. This is one advantage. The other advantage is that it will be green propulsion, not chemical propulsion, because the climbers will move up and down using either laser energy, so electrical energy, or you will actually have solar power available to climbers, and they will use solar power to go up and down.
Yeah.
So it will not be chemical propulsion. So it's kind of a green space transportation system.
Yeah. God, it sounds amazing. And just before I let you go, Aaron, why is the whole world not focused on this one singular project? Because the benefits of it seem enormous.
The benefits are enormous, but the costs involved are also enormous. You need to spend, I guess, not just tens of billions, maybe even $100 billion. Look, we have space debris, which is a huge problem. But nobody is willing to spend money to bring the space debris down.
Yeah.
So, yes, when we have competing interests, we then try to see where we will spend our money so that we can get much more immediate return.
Yeah.
Space elevator is not going to be operational for maybe 30 to 40 years. As Sir Arthur Clarke once said that, you know, space elevator will be built 10 years after, people stop laughing.
Well, you know... there's some buddies of yours in the U.S. military that might find $100 billion down the back of a couch by the sounds of it. That might be one way of finding some way to help it track people, or find some way to help it in its use in warfare. And you might find $100 billion turns up quite easily. Really interesting speaking with you, Aaron. And thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, and it was nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, 100 billion is a lot of money. But I do think there's a bunch of stuff we're doing on the planet that, you know, that we could just scrap and just focus on this one thing. I know Aidan agrees. A space elevator would be an awesome, cool.
100%.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome,
I'm 100% in agreement with you. Any number of projects we could drop for the space elevator, as far as I'm concerned. I wonder, would you have people... You definitely have daredevils like trying to scale the space elevator. Like,
Like Golden Gate Bridge. All right, it's time to look at, back at some of your comments from last week's program. We were talking about pandemics and the inevitability, I suppose, of more on the horizon. Someone says, are you for real? Sack that presenter. He's useless. Accepting increases in pandemics without any real questions. Why the hell would there be an increase in pandemics? Well, I suppose historically, we've had pandemics. And if we look at just recently, we had a pandemic. It's kind of crazy, I think, in a way, to assume that we'll never have another pandemic. And I guess that's why you speak to experts in these things to ask if they think there's going to be a new pandemic. And most experts say, yes, there will. In fact, I don't think there's any expert in any of these areas that would say we're done with pandemics now, thank goodness. So
there's also a really logical reason why you would have more pandemics now than in the past.
And that's more moving to people.
Globalized travel. That's what happened to the native peoples in Americas. They got hit by travel from a different part of the world.
Yeah. So I kind of think we probably will have more pandemics. But yeah, I'll take your argument that I don't ask any real questions. That's for sure.
And definitely you should be sacked.
Yeah, well, for many other reasons that we can't go in here for legal reasons. Another person says, does science not continually prove itself wrong? That's one way of looking at it. I would say that the point of science is to keep asking, is this right? And every once in a while you might say, well, yes, but every once in a while it gets something horribly wrong. It seems like in anthropology it happens all the time.
Yeah.
Paleoanthropology seems to constantly be ripping up the textbooks. But I think, you know, most scientific endeavors, particularly in the worlds of medicine, physics and so on, they do seem to incrementally improve. But yeah, I mean, people do get things wrong. They tend not to be enormous things anymore. We do tend to have, you know, a pretty good grasp on things. But yeah, I mean, people make mistakes. We're all human.
Maybe one of the great things about it is it's sort of historically it guards us against human hubris. It's like we don't know that much. We're still trying to find out stuff.
Mm.
That's the way to look
at it. Yeah, I mean, and I've got to say, I don't think there's anything wrong with being wrong. Like, it's okay to be wrong. And make mistakes and go, yeah, I got that wrong. I would love it if our politicians did that a lot more. And I have to say,
absolutely.
I was at an event with Micheál Martin only recently, European and American Cancer Forum, and Micheál Martin spoke at it about the smoking ban. And there, I was reminded that he was one of the few politicians who stood up and said, I was wrong about the abortion amendment, the 8th. I've listened to people and I've changed my mind. That just doesn't happen very often. So hats off, in fairness. Another text has come in about the Voyager theme being used in the show.
Who made that decision?
the Star Trek geek, our producer. Someone says the Star Trek Voyager theme. Someone says the Star Trek Voyager theme. Really? Only the listeners to this show would recognize that. I wouldn't recognize it, to be honest, but producer Aidan is delighted. Another says, if Star Trek has taught us anything, we shouldn't be worried about where the Voyager is heading until it suddenly starts heading back towards Earth. Yes. If Voyager comes back, we're in big trouble.
Yes.
But I love that. I mean, like, that Voyager thing sounds very similar to the kind of the basic ideas in the three-body problem. At least some of the themes touched on it. And it's kind of, it makes it very real. You know, sending this message out into Earth, into space, and not knowing who's going to find it or what they're going to do with it or how they're going to interpret it. Like, stupidly dangerous thing to do if we assume that aliens exist, which we kind of have to.
Yeah. But we need to know. It'll be grand.
Yeah, look, do you know what? We've had a good run on this.
We had a great run, yeah. I'm sure they'll all be very, very friendly anyway.
Future Proof was produced by Aidan McKelvey. That's it from us on this week's programme. We'll see you in the next episode, which is on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.